So I'm here with Scott Moore, co-founder of Gitcoin today. Scott, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the meaning of public goods and their influence on the social fabric. So the economics textbook definition of a public good is that of a good that's both non-excludable and non-rivalrous. So once provided, you can't stop anyone from benefiting from the good, and the benefit of one person does not take away from the amount that others can consume. So beyond that formal definition, how do you think about public goods and how do you think they shape society?
It's a really important question. And I think when we rely on the textbook definition, we often run into this problem of thinking, oh, like things like the clubs we belong to, the social groups we belong to are not public goods. They're what are called club goods. And that's true, like by definition, there's like a difference. I think the important thing to recognize is that public is a very like broad term, which is context dependent. So if you're sort of in a local community and you have a park, that park is a public good to the citizens of that particular area, but it's not necessarily a public good to the entire society at large. I mean, even at a, country level, roads, bridges, those are like common public goods. But if you can't get into the country, if you're not allowed into the country, they're certainly not public goods for you as a person. Without that access. So there's different degrees and spheres of the public, and therefore there's different sort of degrees of public goods. And that's a really important thing to realize when we're thinking about like, the kinds of public goods we want to see in the world and like how we want to fund them, because it really matters, both in terms of like, what is highest priority to really fund, but also like what mechanisms or methods do we use to actually fund them. Apologies for my voice. Because ultimately, if you run into this problem of, things being too global or too hyperlocal in different contexts, you run into a lot of issues that you may not have otherwise anticipated without having that context. So anyway, that's like a very long intro explanation. One thing I want to just quickly mention is that I actually really enjoy, and this kind of goes back to the club goods point, the definition of public goods as things that produce positive externalities. So, things that provide some kind of external, like, I mean, benefit to the people around them. It emanates like goodwill or emanates like some kind of like true value. And a good example would be like a sort of like university in a large city. It's most, I mean, often not public. Often, even if they are public, the kinds of people that university actually serves pay money. They're part of a group for a certain period of time. They're part of, their university class. They have tuition. But the good that education provides is public ultimately and provides back to society. So there's certainly something there in terms of how we redefine public goods, principally in terms of positive externalities. And I'll, pause there, but I think in Web3, that's also particularly important.
Yeah. And to think about the meta, maybe before getting into the concrete of what Gitcoin is working on, how do you think about a world with functioning public goods funding? Like, what would that look like?
I mean, yeah, like it certainly doesn't function as well as it could today. I think it's unfortunate to say, because like I think there's lots of ways in which existing structures do a very good job in many countries of providing for people in various contexts. There's many contexts in which, or times where they just don't. And that often is true with, it's much easier for a mayor to like create a park and to like create a local public good. It's much harder for someone to agree to coordinate with five other, or like even 150 other countries to solve something like climate change. And we run into this global tragedy of the commons because it's a lot more difficult. And the pandemic is another great example of this, even currently, where when you have to coordinate across large groups globally, the incentives really break down and people end up kind of like going off in their own directions and no one really solves the problem. And so if you look at like going back to climate change, like COP26 happened this year. That's like the climate summit that the UN helps put on. I'm still glad that initiative exists, but it's been literally 26 years and it happens annually. And we still have like what I think most climate scientists would call a pretty serious crisis in climate. So it becomes a problem of, like at what point do those institutions break down? And at what point do we need to sort of rethink the way in which we coordinate on that global scale? And that's part of what we're doing. And I don't think Web3 is the only solution there, but we certainly need to think at this point, I believe, like outside the box on these issues.
Yeah. And in kind of solving these large scale coordination problems then with Web3 or other mechanisms, are there any kind of projects that you'd like to highlight or anything interesting that you've stumbled upon like during the years of really like out of the box thinking that is kind of tackling that?
I'm definitely biased towards, like quadratic funding is one tool. And that's just because that's like where I spend a lot of my time, but I'll maybe say that for a bit. But like the pieces that are particularly interesting to me are mostly around, there's lots of things in Web3 that are like DeFi or like focused on how we exchange value between each other. And those things tend to be like kind of like degen in a sense. And I think increasingly you're seeing a lot of tooling that's trying to figure out ways for those to be like more like, I guess, regen. That's like sort of meme that's emerged. And I think there's a lot of interesting tools where, previously we thought, you have to have like public sort of incentives, government incentives to, even for me, like that's conflating two notions of public, by the way. But like, even in the context of, most laws, you're kind of telling people, hey, this is like a bad behavior and we are going to like, penalize you for like taking part in it. Like, for example, like gambling. But one of the interesting like takeaways is that gambling gets like taxed in like, most countries. Now what that does is ideally it disincentivizes gambling. And that's probably a good thing. But it doesn't, and the taxes are good for the overall society, but it doesn't actually like give you alignment of incentives between like, and this is a like not great example because like in many ways it's a good thing to disincentivize, but it doesn't give you alignment between the people who want to do the thing and the people who basically are, trying to figure out like, actively how to create some positive benefit for society through the provision of public goods. And so taxes in this context and gambling are at odds. And like what you could do and what's happening in sort of like some of the regen space, things like ClimaDAO, is they're just like aligning those incentives together and saying, by participating in the system, you're effectively like in ClimaDAO's case, I think what they're doing is creating like the ability for you to like effectively purchase and facilitate the sort of market for like carbon offsets. So you're basically like taking behavior that would normally be like very counterproductive, honestly, to except if you, buy into the idea of like it providing liquidity and so forth and, the sort of market context, but like it generally would be seen as not ideal. And you're seeing that behavior actually start to really like create these positive externalities, even if it's kind of beyond the scope of what we would consider like, ideal individual behavior. And that's really important because it's very hard to stop people from taking individual behavior of some kind, not specifically gambling, that's like, kind of short-term gain, but like long-term pain, basically. Like people will very easily go towards those things. There's a great example, I forget what the economics paper is, now in name, but it shows, it's an example of a concert basically. And like, you can kind of model out like, at a concert, people will stand up and try and get a better view of what's happening in front of them. And as it happens, more and more people will stand up because it's just like harder for them to see. And then it just creates this cascade effect. And if you sort of look at that over time, you know, what you end up in is a state where like almost everyone is standing, but there's still actually a few people that are like always sitting in these scenarios. But obviously they're the worst off, and they're like kind of like trying to create a better outcome for everyone. But it's clearly like you've gone from a better state in which most people can see relatively well to a worse state in which like only the people at the very front are actually like mostly seeing, you know, what they actually came there to see. And that sort of like is just a very specific example of, you know, this problem of like people just like defaulting to the immediate sort of like incentive that's in front of them of like, oh, like now I can't see, I should like stand up too. And, you know, it's a natural sort of like behavior that I think people can be like that a lot of people are able to kind of like ward off or like prevent in many contexts. But you know, even for myself, I'm sure there's things where like I have a bad habit where like I don't, you know, realize it, or I like am not able to really like, and anyway, this is like a bit of a tangent, but the point is that this sort of model gives us a way to actually like create positive externalities through those like sort of like natural human instincts, which I think is like kind of interesting. And I think it needs to be, by the way, like used very carefully. But I think it's a very kind of novel model in the sense that like, you know, we haven't really been able to see what that looks like in a global scale before. So I'm super excited just about like what that eventually, you know, that world sort of looks like in the coming sort of like, you know, decades. I think we have to be, again, very careful with it. One other final point on that, which is just really interesting to me, is that there's always a percentage of people that stay sitting, but also if you reset the game, it always takes like a certain period of time for people to stand up again. It always takes like there's always this kind of like great, like period in which everything is great. So there's like two solutions. There's like the solution of, you know, figure out how to get more people to be the people that are sitting, figure out how to make the people standing actually contribute positively versus contribute negatively to the broader positive externalities, or just like reset the game continuously. And actually it's interesting to note that because like Web3 itself at large is kind of a reset.
Yeah. And I'm quite curious too, we've touched upon it a little bit perhaps, but there's also some interesting considerations when one thinks about the future of philanthropy, maybe in the face of crypto. So you have all these people with newfound wealth, combined with like norms of generally like openness and kind of like rule breaking and experimentation. So they might fund things that, you know, the aristocrats of like centuries past like might have never, you know, put their hands on. So how do you think that kind of like norm combination with like this newfound wealth will actually change also in the coming decades, how philanthropy might be done?
So it's actually really interesting to look back at like ancient, I don't know, it's maybe not ancient civilizations, but if you go back to ancient Athens or like the sort of like BC era of Greece, like, you know, Plato, like that sort of range, there's this concept that emerged of liturgies. And liturgies are kind of this idea that individual like wealthy members of society would effectively be like given or assigned or given the option to pick. It depended on a lot of like different pieces, but essentially the idea was they were given the responsibility as part of their duty as a citizen to provision a particular public good. And actually like a very, like a literally like, you know, the aqueducts are like really in bad disrepair, we need to fix them, that kind of thing. And it was actually really useful for them to have this sort of like direct accountability to a particular kind of public good. And I think one thing that's interesting about Web3 is the ability for us to actually like create incentives for people to kind of pick and choose and fund some of these individual public goods, and to be kind of like, you know, in terms of norms on the one hand, Vitalik has a great post about this around, you know, legitimacy and like what it means to have legitimacy in Web3. So there's the normative element, but there's also like the mechanics, like the incentive element in terms of how we convince people to fund those individual public goods. And one of those mechanisms is definitely, I think, both on the normative kind of like side and on the incentive side, is quadratic funding. And the way it works basically is it's kind of a more democratic form of crowdfunding in the sense that the number of contributors to a project matters more than the dollar amounts contributed. So if you have like one project that gets two $4 donations and another that gets eight $1 donations, the matching amount for the former would be $16. The matching amount for the latter would be $64. The math doesn't really matter, but it's $8, you know, in both cases being donated. And you can just like kind of like look at the fact that because you're taking the square of the sum of the square roots of contributions, the latter amount is, you know, pretty much just like giving you a huge match relative to the, you know, one in which there's less donors. The reason that's important is not only are you donating to public goods, you're actually creating a signal as to what basically, and I should explain actually. So you have the individual donations, you have a matching pool. The matching pool is distributed according to those individual donations. And the way that the matching is distributed is according to that idea that I just mentioned. And so when you actually like are donating as an individual to these goods, you're creating signal that then determines where these funds are distributed. And the reason that's so powerful is because you're actually participating in the process of defining what actually is a public good. So unlike liturgies in which you have like individual goods kind of like assigned to you by some other body, you're actually like assigning some value alongside the rest of like, you know, the population to those goods. And effectively, you know, the wealthiest people who are potentially also donating to the matching pool can then like just assign their value according to the will of the people in a sort of democratic fashion. And so the reason that's a really important piece is that you actually end up with one, like signal of what should people think about as public goods. Two, you know, how should we think about like funding those relative to that signal in the future in other ways, like, you know, even just via regular centralized grants programs or via individual philanthropic donations beyond the system itself. And that to me is like where I think we're really starting to see new sort of like value emerge is in this process of like iterating on our own expectations of, again, like kind of being meta, like what, you know, what good is in this case, not what public is. And that process is really powerful to me. But yeah, there's lots of other mechanisms that I think innovate on philanthropy here. And, you know, even those ones I mentioned, or like ClimateOut, are kind of an example of that. Your individual self-interest to invest in something, you know, that might like have, you know, XYZ return for you also happens to produce carbon credits and also happens to provide a benefit, you know, more broadly to society. And that's something that is, you know, if you look at in Canada, which I'm in Toronto, there's like, you know, most of the companies on the market are just like resource companies. They're like mining companies or like forestry companies, or they're like banks, so like financial companies. And, you know, those are fundamentally like there's extraction involved in that. Like if you could just create markets for things that were actually like better for the world, it just like flips those incentives on its head. So you've got, on the one hand, yeah, like models like quadratic funding, which are much more philanthropic, they still rely on people's individual goodwill, but they also kind of leverage people's ability and interest in signaling the work that they're doing. And then on the other hand, you've got, you know, these sort of like more individual self-interest incentive models. There's a lot of other interesting models too, like conviction voting, commitment voting, retroactive public goods funding, but I'll pause there because I can just keep going.
All right. So what do you think with projects that might have failed in the past that were kind of like in the public goods funding space too? What do you think is like the maybe like the most common misconception or like the danger that people will run into? Where does the thinking go wrong? And what's like a common theme that you've seen that makes like projects actually fail?
I think a lot of the issue is that, you know, on the one hand, I think it's like the issue of incentives, thinking through like what will people say that they'll do, like what is it that people are going to say they'll do versus what they'll actually do? And then how do you also ensure that, you know, there's you know, real sort of like momentum. I think a lot of like the other kind of big piece is just a lot of projects in Web3, especially, were too early in many dimensions. Like DAO is a great example of this. Like I actually worked on a DAO project in 2015-16 before I was working on Gitcoin. And, you know, at that point, no one really cared about DAOs. Then the DAO hack happened unrelated. And so that was like the end of DAOs for a while. In terms of a lot of other public goods funding projects that were Web3 native, there's this kind of history in terms of subcultures in the space that emerges, you know, at the very center of the start from the Bitcoin community in like, you know, the early Bitcoin days. A lot of that sentiment was very libertarian. It really focused on like, there wasn't a lot of interest in that sort of idea of giving back or the idea of how you might, you know, create positive externalities. There was certainly no discussion of like provisioning public goods. There were often conversations about how private goods might be, you know, able to just solely replace like any kind of public infrastructure we may have. And that, I think, was not an environment that was very conducive to like doing a great job creating these kinds of projects. And in the early sort of like 2014, 15 era, you know, as Ethereum started to sort of like, you know, come into existence, I definitely think a lot of people were more willing to move into this idea of creating these sorts of projects. But even then, the problem was that no one was really able to use these tools. Getting users for any kind of Web3 project at the time was like pipe dream. It, maybe five people would try out your thing if you like posted it on the right forum. But like that was not really, you know, a substantial, you know, sort of audience. And so the main issues were, yeah, like one, just like taking time culturally for the sort of more anarchistic libertarian ideas of, you know, blockchain TM or Bitcoin to kind of like come back to reality a bit, in my opinion, like to come back to the idea that like, hey, like it doesn't need to, you know, the way that we work as a like and coordinate with each other doesn't need to rely on like some centralized massive institution. We do need to coordinate with each other. There's still a need, a fundamental reason for us to find ways to like, to, you know, interact and to like share value and to like reciprocate. And so that was, to me, I think, the big unlock. And then, you know, the user base that emerged in 2017, 2018 was like the next big unlock. But I still think, I don't know if we're quite there yet. Like, I think there's still a lot of work to be done to like, and it certainly happened over like the last 3 years or so. So, you know, now people actually understand that public goods are a thing largely. They are largely on board with, yes, let's like figure out ways to fund them. And even for us, we've seen massive growth in the amount of funding that's going through these experiments that we're running. So that's been like just awesome to see on our side. But in large part, the challenge is still there of, you know, and we talked about this just a bit like before we started, like how we define our values, how we make sure that we're all like going in the same direction. And I think the next stage is just like, now that we sort of are roughly aligned on public goods, that we, you know they're important, that we have mechanisms to fund them, how do we, you know, level up the models by which we coordinate long-term to commit to this model? And that might be, you know, using things like commitment voting, conviction voting. It might just be through a kind of giving pledge that the ecosystem commits to. And that's sort of like the model that I'm really excited to like sort of see, you know, in the coming years.
Yeah. So on the conviction and commitment building, could you just like introduce those two concepts real quick? Because I actually don't know quite what they are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'll definitely call me out on that, because I'll definitely mention terms. And like if you don't call me out, I'll just kind of pass by them. But like conviction voting, there's actually, funny enough, for me even, there's a distinction between conviction and commitment voting that I don't quite remember, which is unfortunate. But the idea roughly is that you're trying to basically stake your interest in some particular, you know, idea or topic or public good, let's say, over a longer period of time. And the length at which you agree to, like, but how long you choose to fund that for, or how long you choose to interact with that for, effectively by, like, say, staking tokens or some other, you know, broad mechanism by which you just, like, signal your long-term interest in a particular topic, that gives you additional rewards, or it gives, like, additional funding to the, or voting weight in the case of, like, conviction voting, to the idea at large. And that's important because you're just showing through that process, the same reason that quadratic funding, one thing I didn't mention, is useful. It gives you skin in the game as an individual. When you are voting for something to be a public good, you are doing so by donating to that thing. And that requires you to, like, give something up in the process. Conviction voting requires you to give up a lot. If you're, you know, staking something for, like, 5 years and just have no understanding of, like, you know, exactly what will happen over that time, there's a lot of uncertainty. So you can imagine, like, the bond market kind of works this way, except the bond market, like, kind of, like, you know, arguably doesn't really produce a ton of positive externalities and has a lot of complexity and, like, unnecessary, like, pieces in my uneducated view. But, like, the way that this works is kind of similar in the sense that, like, you're kind of taking a, you know, the kind of, like, you know, duration of this this lockup as a signal as to, like, how interested you really are in this idea. And that's important just because, yeah, it's again, that concept of, like, giving someone, you know, skin in the game, having some sense of, you know, the true relevance this has to someone's life. And it's particularly interesting because it doesn't require you to have any particular amount of, like, capital or amounts of, like, voting power to begin with. You actually are just able to, like, you know, in many cases, if you locked something up for, like, 10 years and someone else with way more capital locked it up, or way more voting power locked it up for 1 year, you may actually end up with, like, a larger amount of overall, like, power in that system. And that's probably a good measure of, like, you know, how you should think about power is how invested, just in terms of their time and energy, and literally, like, you know, conviction, are they in this idea? So that's, like, a very high level, yeah, overview. I'm not sure if that's, like, perfect, but hopefully, yeah, if anyone listening can also, like, kind of, like, provide a link, and I can also provide some links after.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Maybe you could concretize, like, this general idea with, like, some example, like, either if this has happened or just, like, an imaginary one.
So, yeah, in terms of conviction voting, like, imagine you have, you know, well, I mean, I wish I had a better, like, concrete example, but let's say you have, like, a vote as to what particular, like, kinds of, you know, there's an empty public space. Should it be a park? Should it be, you know, a, like, just like a commerce center or whatever? You can have people basically, like, you know, individual citizens go in and, like, I mean, it's going to be easier actually to give you just, like, a similar abstract example, I think, to, like, the one that I gave with quadratic funding. So, like, the 10-year and 1-year example is good. So let's say you have, like, you know, $10 you want to, like, sort of stake as a commitment to the idea that, you know, there'll be a park in this area. And let's say, you know, someone else has, you know, $1,000 they want to commit to the idea of there being a commerce center in that area. The 10-year, you know, lockup may actually end up, you know, creating, let's say, like, 100 points total voting power. So, like, that's, like, their, like, now, like, stake and ability to influence decisions about how this particular plot of land or space is used. The person with $1,000 might, you know, only actually end up getting in the calculation, like, 10 points of similar value. And so you would need just a lot more of those people over time to really, like, commit. And of course, like, you know, those people may actually lose interest faster or, like, lose value faster in the system, because after the year's up, they might decide, like, oh, well, like, we're not really getting anywhere with this commerce center idea. Like, we're just going to remove our stake. And, like, now you have, like, an even higher percentage of people who have, like, voting power in the system, basically, you know, voting for the park over time and voting for, like, changes to the park over time and generally governing this space. So it's kind of, like, yeah, very simple, just about, like, you know, the amount of time versus the amount of, like, either capital or, like, attention or other, like, some other means, some other scarce resource, being put into, combination to measure your commitment to a space.
Right. But then if the people with kind of the bigger purchasing power kind of like all converge on like a particular, like the commerce center, say, and the people with maybe more time and energy, but less spending power, do prefer maybe the park. How do you reconcile the two? Because it obviously does take like a lot of capital to build either, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of like with quadratic funding, like the expectation in quadratic funding is that, you theoretically could have like 10,000 whales, each with like $10,000, all converge on a project and be like, this is it. This is the project that's going to get like all the funding in this particular round. You don't see that happen partly because there's less people with that amount of capital. So like, it's much harder for that to like be rallied, but also the amount that people actually care, like who have $10,000 to spend, the amount of people who care $10,000 worth about this idea is like way less than the amount of people who care like $1 worth. So you just naturally get this like sort of balance where, and at least so far, we haven't really seen any of those. Like the only attacks we've seen really that stand out are like these sort of like, there's like this meme that we've come up with of like squadratic funding, in which like you just have a squad that like really cares about one thing. And you can kind of see, like if you look at like, you analyze the data, you can see how they're like basically voting in the system. And you can see that they're all kind of like voting at similar times or like together in other ways. But like, it's pretty much like, it's not really collusion because like they all just happen to be in the same sort of group that cares about the same thing. And those sorts of squads typically, yeah, they don't have like huge amounts of capital between them. But like, we haven't really seen that, like sort of like, someone like trying to throw in like, $500,000 between like 50 of like their like friends to like try and really push something ahead in the rounds. It's certainly a risk, but like it's in fact a risk that the mechanism is explicitly trying to dampen. Like you can imagine the formula is like creating a dampening effect on the capital portion of like the calculation.
Yeah, and regarding collusion then, at one point would you say collusion is occurring indeed? Because if there is like, internal communication and like a set time and maybe like money value that's actually kind of being expanded, where does non-collusion end and where does collusion begin?
It's very hard to actually, like, that's a very subjective question as well. And like, it comes back to partly the notion of the public, like we're always going to come back to the notion of the public, but like, there's also the question of what was the intention behind the action? Like, were they trying to simply, so here's a good example of what is collusion. Like if you have like a wallet address and you just give people money to go and donate on your behalf to a project, like, I'm not sure if I should say this, cause like, I guess people could like start working around it. But like, that's obviously collusion, because you basically are like informing, it'd be as if like I bribed you to donate, to vote for a certain like, elected official. Like that sort of behavior is like clearly like out of bounds for the system. In this case, yeah, like that's a great example of just like very clear collusion. The other example that I would say is, not collusion would be that squad example. It just like, if people are kind of like, if I know five people and we're all like, hey, I think, Wallet Connect is a really cool project. Like, I think Wallet Connect is actually what powers like a lot of like Rainbow Wallet and a lot of like these Web3 wallets today. And if I think that's really cool and like I convince 10 other people that they also think it's really cool, I don't think that's really collusion at all. That's just like me trying to like advocate for something being good. And we see this on Twitter during, Bitcoin grants rounds, which is like the name of like how we do the quadratic funding rounds in the first place, all the time. And basically we just run into this problem where, actually in some cases, people are like too good at like pitching their grant. And that like creates this like kind of like, cycle in which they're like constantly on top of crypto Twitter, which is like a really big place for like overall collaborations space. I'm actually not sure how many people listening will already get these terms or like if I should like explain them.
I think they're probably familiar with most. Yeah.
Okay, cool. The ultimate, you know, challenge of that is just like, how do we ultimately get to a stage in which, the popularity of a grant, is not like a factor in its success. This is also a problem with elections, right? And you see this often with historically, you see TV stars or other folks, not to name any names, being elected for the sake of the fact that they're popular or they have people know the name. And that's a huge issue because ultimately that's not a good indicator at all of the quality of something in a lot of cases. Although in the case of Web3, there's an interesting kind of dynamic of something can be popular and not be good, but something can also be and something can be unpopular but be good. But there's also things that and this is what retroactive public goods funding, which the Optimism team is working on, kind of principally focuses on, is Austin Griffith has created this sort of huge range of developer tooling in Web3, especially within the context of what he's doing with Scaffold E. And that's given him a lot of credibility and legitimacy in space. And therefore people, often go back and fund his work very, very frequently. He's gained a lot of popularity and sort of notoriety for that. And so there's nothing necessarily wrong with retroactively going back and funding Austin's work because you feel it's had a huge impact. But there's definitely a difference between funding something historically because of an impact it's had, versus going back and funding something because it's popular, it's coming up a lot in your radar. And the question of when is something popular, when is something impactful, is a huge question even beyond Web3. And that's just if you look at any Web2 platform, influencers are a great example of this. It's how do you know if an influencer is actually is doing stuff, or if an influencer, how do you know whether or not Kim Kardashian is actually having impact on the world, or is just really popular? Sometimes that the answer is more obvious than others. So anyway, I'll leave that there.
Yeah. I find that really interesting too, because I think politics is a lot like that as well, where there's a lot of people, maybe actually not a lot of people, quite a few, maybe a handful of people in Congress who have actually figured out Twitter and are really good at it, but might be kind of on top of everyone's mind, yet don't really get any proposals through. Nobody's actually looking at the bills that are passed and kind of looking at the political impact. I wonder though, that does not seem like an ideal situation to me yet. I don't know. Maybe you have thoughts on that too. How one would circumvent that in the future, whether that's just always going to be kind of part of the human condition. We're kind of suckers for pretty faces and kind of charismatic leaders and such. How do you think about ever kind of moving past that?
So I think actually it's kind of ties back to the university and the beginning, in the sense that education is and this is true, every thinker on democratic principles, going all the way back to era of Plato and so forth, talks about the idea of an educated population being necessary for a democracy. One of the reasons I think you get people who are very pro technocracy or very pro having some other group making decisions is when education breaks down. And sometimes that's malicious. Sometimes I think people making those claims are not really even pro education and very happy to have a population that's more uneducated and happy to be able to take power and make decisions. But often I think it's just people forget about the importance of that. And I think we lose sight of how to actually maintain that kind of public good. I should shout out to Kernel, which is our sort of Web3 public syllabus for values and principles and ideas that we think are really important in Web3, for people that are pretty new to the space, just giving them a rough rundown of here are the principles that might make sense in Web3 for you to think about. But in general, in broader society, I think civic education is you know, and voter turnout and all these like metrics, like they're very low in the US and Canada too. And I think that is, you know, we never really thought about the internet as a civic space. And like, I think now, you know, we're in this world where like maybe we'll have Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse or whatever. And that to me is, you know, kind of like the equivalent of us just having like a monarchy and, you know, the early back in the day before we had like democracies. And so I guess like, you know, one, in just regular real life, like we need better civic education, but we especially need that civic education because it turns out that all the other spheres in which we're now operating, like this like sort of metaverse is as its own sphere, I think is like pretty fair to say now. I mean, like with what we're doing in Web3, like it's not just, you know, in Web1 it was read, in Web2 it was write, in Web3 like people are talking about it being owned. And like I think that's because there's an economy now where there wasn't before that's tied to the actual information that's flowing. So, you know, in Web2, you had the idea of like, you know, you can pay some company, you know, for their SaaS like business model to like have some access to some service. And now we actually have to have, you know, it's a wonderful like addition to have ownership and to be able to like have a real say in what's happening on the internet. That was the original semantic web vision in Web1, related to like, for example, like one of the interesting ideas of the semantic web was like the Facebook like which was just meant to be a generalized principle for like how we operate on the web, i.e. everything can be annotated or everything can be sort of, you know, independently reviewed by anyone. And then that just kind of like slowly, you know, became a vestigial concept, and the Facebook like was sort of the only thing left. And now we have the actual ability to like, you know, govern these online spaces. So we have to, you know, also pour over whatever learnings we have about how to improve civic education in the real world to how we actually govern these spaces. So that's a really, again, long answer, but hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah. Do you think crypto per se can do much in kind of like the civic education sphere? Like if that seems like a very kind of like analog problem and probably like really, you know, like long problem. Like there's always been kind of like the question of education. Like you went back to Plato, right? And I think like that's always been like realized, yet we've never seemed to have found a kind of like ideal way to take care of it like effectively. Like it seems to constantly reoccur. How do you think like crypto, Web3, could potentially have a job at it? Or is it just something where like, I don't know, like you don't really see a lot of overlap?
So I think the biggest reason that Web3 gives us a lot of benefits here is that previously, so like one thing I really want to hit home is that, you know, most of the time when we're talking about coordination, people are just trying to like figure out some kind of common goal and trying to figure out how they like all work together towards it. And there's no real need to like think carefully about the structure of what that actually looks like as much as we think. And often we think, and what I mean by that specifically is like, you know, if we look back in the last like 200, 300 years, a lot of what we coordinate through are like LLCs or C-Corps in the US or in, you know, governmental capacities. Like we use like a certain legislative system with like, you know, representatives, and we have like a whole system ideally of checks and balances, and that, you know, all those models are kind of, they have their benefits, but they're not the only models that we can actually rely on. And in fact, in many cases, they are like known to be suboptimal, like in the US or any first past the post system. So a system in which like once someone basically like hits that like threshold, they're the winner. You end up with there's this concept like called Arrow's impossibility theorem. It's like one of the few theorems that actually intersects with political science. I'm not sure if that's true now actually, because in the last like 5 or so years, like since I studied like political science and math way back in university, but like there's actually a lot of really interesting like computational like political science work that's happening now. But the problem with like basically the issue with like the current system is that, you know, we basically have very little actual say in the way that things are done. We have like a model that we've like relied on for like 300 plus years that is like the default. And, you know, there's many reasons that like both structurally that's bad, but also like that really wears down people's motivation to participate in these systems. It's very cumbersome for anyone to like start, you know, thinking about, and we're at a kind of stage of, you know, the economy now where it's also very hard for people to like imagine how they might be able to like, you know, leave their jobs or like start a new company or, so these structures which are like meant to be facilitating kind of progress or facilitating like, you know, and someone's ongoing, you know, change and participation are really just like kind of stagnant in my opinion, in a lot of ways. And I think what Web3 gives you the ability to do is just run a whole bunch of experiments like in parallel, pretty much globally in an almost kind of like, not instant, but like very fast, like kind of rough, sort of like, you know, sometimes perhaps too rough, too like disorganized a fashion. But ultimately, at least right now, fortunately, a lot of the stakes are like not that high. And especially a couple of years back, like we're not that high in these systems. And so like for us, like experimenting with say quadratic funding was like really, you know, we were putting $100,000 or say at stake, like in like the first couple of rounds we did. Now we're putting like $2 million at stake in these rounds and we're slowly moving up, but we're able to do that because we actually have, you know, a really quick turnaround time in like how, like basically like how we analyze the data from these, how we iterate on the model, and then how we like run the next experiment. For a government or for like even a large company to do that takes forever. And I would argue even a startup, which like historically was kind of like the model of, oh, like if you want to move fast and break things, like here's how you do it, is not really all that fast or all that effective in like actually making change, because the systems in which you operate are still very, very slow. Like, and that's true. Like anyone who's tried to like start a company and like has to go and like start their like bank account and like set up like all the relevant, like it's a pain and it takes forever and it's like a whole thing. And like, you know, I don't think that we should just run any experiment we want. I think there's lots of experiments that like absolutely like should not be run in any circumstance. And like, I think that like there's in Web3 though, a lot of these sort of like bumpers around like, you know, what we're actually going to be able to test well and like what could actually work really well. And that gives us this like freedom and flexibility, which admittedly I don't think we'll have in like 5 years time as this starts to become like more mainstream. Even now it's like certainly harder to like experiment like in a vacuum, but the beauty is that like you mostly have the ability to define the number of people that are going to be like, you know, joining a DAO, let's say, a DAO being like a decentralized autonomous organization, or like, you know, mostly just like a group of people with a group chat that also happen to have a multi-sig with funds in crypto in it. I think that's the best definition of like a DAO I've heard, is just like, it's just a group chat and a multi-sig, which is true in a lot of cases. And like that gives you the flexibility to like, you know, just iterate continuously in a way that like isn't really that high risk. And yeah, I mean, I'll keep rambling otherwise, but I think that's a really key point just in terms of how we think about like what the power of Web3 is and why that changes civic engagement. I think it's all about like running those experiments. And also just fundamentally being able to have a change in the norms around, oh, the system in the US is like great, you know, the founders must have had a really good like, you know, model for how they were thinking about things. We can't change that. There's a lot of like still very, we often think based on history or based on like, you know, tradition and based on like what's happened in the past. And I think Web3 gives us the ability to kind of like take away a lot of the like both semantic and then just like actual baggage and just to like run those experiments and to like, you know, do so in a way with these bumpers that like creates like a bit of a like flexible range of possible governance experiments. Yeah, that was a bit of a rant, but
so definitely also like a perspective shift and like seeing structures that might have been around for centuries as like more malleable than maybe like public discourse like usually acknowledges them to be.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we often are just caught in this idea that like, oh, like, so yeah, and like if you think about it, really, like, we exist in a random point in time. We were all born into, like, not to be like, you know, too existential, but it's all kind of like, it is all kind of arbitrary in a sense. And that's not to say that it's meaningless. It's just to say that like, there's a lot of ways in which we can like shape our own understanding of the world and our own sort of like ways in which we interact with the world. Even just going, honestly, like even going back to like, if you look at how Native American civilizations like operated, they didn't use a representative democracy, like sort of like that model. In fact, actually the IETF, which governs by consensus, is probably the closest modern like existing example of those practices, not to like conflate them, because I think it's really important for that, like, you know, culturally to be like seen as it's distinct and like sort of like an important sort of like piece. But I think that the even those models we've often forgotten about, and like I think that's like a really important distinction that like we can now make in Web3 or in these other systems because we have that flexibility.
Yeah. And this is a bit of a topic switch, but I was also curious to kind of like talk about the role of art for tech development, because preparing for this conversation, I kind of noticed that in its writing, Gitcoin often includes art of beautiful spaces of the past, or maybe also imaginary ones of the future. So if there is like any elaborate thinking behind that, or just any kind of thoughts whatsoever, how do you think about art and its role in kind of pushing forward tech development?
I definitely think that if you look at most changes, like over like a long span of history, like art is either critical in like instigating them or critical in documenting them. And I think on the one hand, you end up with art being kind of a guiding force, in which, I mean, a good example of this would be, a really kind of like abstract example of this would be like, if you go back to like hieroglyphics or like the semiotic ways in which we like look at language, even a lot of that comes back to art. It comes back to like how we like depict the world around us. And like, so I think art is very closely tied to just like our representations of the world and how we think about the world at large. But then also, yeah, in terms of like, you know, creating and documenting, maybe isn't the right word, like documenting and like commenting on current trends, like art is like counterculture, and it creates this cycle of like culture to counterculture to like, you know, basically like sort of like reimagination and then like to culture, that like keeps us moving forward instead of just becoming like stagnant. The way that we use that in the Gitcoin context, and like I think this is actually a really important point in terms of like the way I think about like, for me, like sci-fi is something that shaped me a lot, which is probably not a surprise to like anyone who's like kind of, you know, I think in tech adjacent spaces, like I think has had like some interaction with sci-fi, which is itself like a good statement, you know, a testament to the fact that like it clearly like has some influence. But we often talk about like very dystopian spaces. We talk about cyberpunk futures or like kind of like, and you can see that just like constantly in like, you know, even like things like this earlier, like maybe even like cypherpunk like writings, like I don't know, like Neuromancer like is a great piece, but also like has like some really dystopian elements. There's like, you know, there's just so many examples, I think, that show us eventually getting to a state in which, wow, we've conquered, you know, the galaxy, or we've like, you know, found like, it's all about like either like massive growth in like a way that's like probably unsustainable, or it's about like we haven't achieved massive growth because we have this like crazy infighting that's happening, and I think both of those cases are like not actually where we want to get to, and so solarpunk is like this sort of idea of a, you know, more sort of integrated like future where, you know, we work directly with nature, with our environment, to try to, you know, directionally shape the, you know, on actually often a very local level, you know, sort of like the public spaces that we're part of, and like try to like integrate technology to ensure that like people have like the security and safety and like the baseline sort of like health and such that they need. And like that is very different from those other sort of worlds that we often see depicted. There's a great, I forget what, it's like one of those like 4x4 matrices where it's like cyberpunk is like high tech, low life, and like solarpunk is like high tech, high life. And cause like, you know, we often think about, this is often one of the criticisms of like accelerationism as well, which is just like, oh, like if we just have technology, it will like solve everything. And then like, we'll like eventually get to like some magical future by default, like where like everything is great. And I think solarpunk is more like, let's take a cautious, like, but like steady approach to like growth and to like how we leverage technology in our daily lives. Anyone who's like, you know, oh, I'm spending way too much time on, like at a very micro level, like I'm spending way too much time on Twitter even myself. Like that's a great example of like a very small thing that we all recognize, like, wait a minute, like, are we all just like kind of caught up in something here where like it's not actually like adding as much value to our lives as we think it actually should? And anyway, so like solarpunk is all about sort of like that balance and like still treating technology as a core piece of our future. And so we try and really think about solarpunk futures in our writing as like where we want to end up. And I think Web3 and solarpunk are very heavily aligned. There's actually a whole history of this with the DWeb movement, which is really goes back way earlier than Web3, which was coined actually as a term by Gavin Wood in like 2014. But like the DWeb movement was really started, you know, even maybe like a decade or more before that, based on all these different peer-to-peer technologies. There's things like Secure Scuttlebutt is an example of this. It's like a ridiculous name, but it's like a peer-to-peer system, like a gossip protocol that is like kind of also the social network. There's like a lot of, you know, work that like Internet Archive has been doing, obviously, to try and like ensure that we have like distributed records of all the different like sort of like an archival history of the internet and like of where we've been. So there's all these different movements that took on this solarpunk ethos in addition, you know, to a kind of like, yeah, like hopefulness for the future that, you know, I think Web3 is very much aligned with and is like sort of started to inherit again, like maybe closer like 2017, 2018, it started to inherit that more than back in like the Bitcoin era. That's like my own personal like belief is that it didn't really, because again, like a solarpunk future does rely on the concept of there being public goods, there being kind of like these like open spaces. There's a great thinker who I won't dive into too much called Ivan Illich, who like talks a little bit about like this sort of work that I would recommend people check out. But that's the gist of like, you know, where I think we want to go. And we're hopeful that like by sharing those visions, we can get other people kind of like starting to talk more about those ideas as well. And again, to your point, like the art we create, the way in which we interact with art, goes back and shapes the worlds that we actually end up in. So like, it's really key to do that.
Yeah, definitely. So another kind of topic switch, but one thing that seems also like fairly dominant in many conversations about crypto, at times maybe almost to sort of a dogmatic degree, is trustlessness. But I'm kind of curious always about the limits to the deterministic encoding that kind of gets idealized. So when it comes to kind of the subjective aspects of human governance, for example, like values in the context of public goods, what gets lost, in your opinion, in kind of the crypto conversation where trustlessness is getting like the most airtime?
So I actually think, fortunately, the idea of like immutability or trustlessness has become less popular, possibly over, like, it's still popular, to be fair. Like, I can't say it's still going on. Like, there's a lot of people talking about, like, for example, like in the context of DAOs, the idea of a group chat and multi-sig is very much not decentralized. It's an area actually in which there's a lot of debate, because if you have a DAO where everyone has like a token and you have like, and for the record, like we take actually a much more representative democracy style approach to our governance, except it's a more of a liquid democratic model versus just like a first past the post style model. And the way that we approach, that sort of governance is just that like any representative can at any time, like, you know, vote via their tokens in a decision for how we, like, you know, for example, fund future matching rounds or what we, to your point, count as collusion. And I think that the big piece of like the multi-sig, the pushback on like the multi-sig group chat version of this, and one of the reasons we like also think that's like not really sufficient for what we're doing, is that degree of like trustlessness and like the decentralization that we're giving to the community. But I do think there's a degree to which we can get too caught up in the idea of like decentralization as the like be all end all. Cause like really what we're trying to do is create systems that allow for anyone to participate and allow for anyone to like have some kind of voice or say in the decisions that are made. And when you have a multi-sig that's totally separate, like I can see, like, I mean, often, you know, it's very much a trustful environment in which you're assuming that they will spend the funds appropriately and they'll listen to the votes and they won't run away. But there's no real guarantee of that. And so I think the thing that people have realized is that we can't have everything be fully decentralized from the very start. We have to take incremental steps, and I think people are okay with that. We also don't need decentralization everywhere. Like just having a global multi-sig and a group chat is actually like pretty good for a lot of cases. If you have a bunch of friends and you're investing in like art together, or like if you're thinking of building like a small project together, but you really don't need some like crazy, like complex, like architecture for your governance. If you have like 10,000 people, you know, in your group, you kind of do, and this kind of goes back to like Dunbar's number, which is just the concept of like, yeah, like 150 people being sort of like the theoretical maps that someone can like hold trust with. And, you know, so I think we often have this like problem where we're like, oh, everything needs to be trustless or decentralized. And again, I think that's improved. Like if you go back to 2015-16, the whole concept of the DAO was that it was a decentralized autonomous organization. And the autonomous was really like a huge piece of this in the concept was smart contracts will just execute, you know, the code. We don't need any like human interaction. It will just magically all take shape on its own. And I think that's like, for most people, like that idea is gone. Like that's like fundamentally absurd. Like the idea that like a, you know, group of people coming together that have to like coordinate, that there'll be no social like dynamics involved there, that it will just be like an entirely economic or like, you know, like code-based system. It's a very idealistic kind of like, again, actually very like kind of a cyberpunk like vision in that sense. Like there's no real like sense of humanity in the idea of a code just executing this like agreement. And so I think we've moved beyond that. I think most of the conversation that I see like doesn't really, I think would agree with like that being kind of an antiquated notion of how we think about what these systems can do. And I think, yeah, like if you look at going like back to the the sort of like Dunbar's number piece, like the place in which that does matter is when you get to these like certain scales, like above, like say, like, I don't know, 10,000 people or like above some large number. But like, we have to think in terms of like, yeah, those scales of like, if you're just like five people, Aaron Swartz actually is a great, I forget what he called it, but Aaron Swartz had a concept of like powers of five in terms of like group dynamics. And the idea was basically that like, yeah, each power of five kind of like changes the kinds of rules and structures that you might need in when you think about these sorts of like structures and like what systems you're designing. So like if you have five people, if you have 25 people, I can't immediately do the other calculation, but like the point is that like there's very much like this sort of shift above Dunbar's number and then just like beyond. And so most of the and the important piece here is that I would say 80% of like what's happening in Web3 right now is not actually at that scale in which you need that much trust or that much trustlessness rather. So it's certainly a conversation that's still being had, but like I think we're moving in the right direction there.
Yeah. And then maybe also another kind of thing that I often observe kind of more from the outside in crypto is maybe like a tension between voice and exit. And exit is kind of like fundamentally like the withdrawal from the current system, and voice is like the inherently more maybe political process of attempting to repair or like improve the system kind of incrementally through like advocacy or communication. I would say like in crypto, people are obviously more on the kind of exit side of the system. But I wonder how you think maybe also about like voice and exit respectively, and how you see, whether you see like fundamental limits to voice.
I think, there are always going to be limits to voice in the sense that any system always, like you can never have a system in which 100% of people are in agreement. Like it's just going to be like, there's always going to be disagreement. There's always going to be conflict. And I think that's okay at certain levels. And like when we like are intentional about how we like address that conflict, the power of like, I think there's two levels of voice, again, going back to like the Dunbar's number piece. So on the one hand, there's like going consensus driven models. There's like the idea of like, and this is, you know, true in the context of like how, like, you know, tribes and such, you know, would make decisions, which is like, not across the board, by the way, but this is one like potential model that was out there, was like by, you know, objection effectively. So you would have like sort of a round table discussion, and you would have a chance for like kind of, you know, reactions, and you have a chance for objections to like an idea, and then you could like kind of like voice those objections, you could like work through them in a small scale. That works really well because everyone has trust, everyone is willing to like address the objections, and you can slowly find consensus through that process as you iterate on it. There's the other idea in like larger systems of voting, and I think we often run into this problem again. Like one of the benefits of the group chat multi-sig like that scale is that you really don't need that complex a voting system. And that means you can move a lot faster. It means you can like move, you know, with a lot more like trust between people. But when you get to a certain scale, I think voting is necessary because you just slowly lose that trust. And so, but voting should always be a last mile way of like having a voice, right? It should always be like kind of a, you know, most of the conversation should still be happening in the same sort of fashion through like discussion, like in social groups. And then at the end, you do the vote just to like kind of like ratify the decision, and hopefully everyone's pretty happy. But at a certain point, if you have like five people, you can probably get all five people to agree on something. If you have 10,000 people, you probably can't get all 10,000 people to like agree on something, you know, on average. And that's where voting kind of becomes like the key piece. And then, you know, that becomes like, you know, it has its limits as well, I guess, is kind of the point. I think in most scenarios, that's sufficient, so long as you design the right voting system, and so long as like you have checks and balances in place. And so long as like it's a model in which you have some form of like, almost I'd call it like a soft exit, like a liquid democracy model in the context of like what we're doing with Gitcoin. There's a soft exit. You're not leaving the system or forking the system. But you are like, for example, saying, I don't think this representative is doing a good job, I'm just going to point my votes at like a different representative and kind of like switch immediately from there. And that's already a huge improvement. But I do think there's probably points at which you want to have the option to exit. I think the idea, like people often, so again, like 80% of like scenarios, let's say, like, I think those two like both like consensus and then like at the like higher levels of voting in various forms are like sufficient. Like I would argue like they're mostly sufficient. It's just that the systems that we have that do those things suck at the moment in like real life. And then like exit is like, I think important, but like necessary, but I think people often are too quick to be like, oh, you know, these systems are like amazing specifically because you have the ability to fork or exit. And I think it shouldn't be seen as like a, you know, like necessarily like a praiseworthy thing to like fork or like exit a system, because it's fundamentally like you are no longer coordinating. You have like, you've lost some kind of like trust. You've like failed to like meet or get some kind of consensus. Like, it's not a good thing to end up in that scenario. Having the option though is like sometimes I think necessary and like important. And I think, yeah, like in the case of like the DAO, you know, Ethereum Classic, like the split happened because people said, oh, actually at the time it was really like, this was one of the key points of immutability versus, you know, kind of consensus, was the current Ethereum chain was like, the DAO hack happened. It was not intended to be that way. We will revert. They reverted basically the transactions effectively, and it moved on as if nothing had sort of happened. And that was okay because there was literally consensus to do so from the network. But people who wanted to exit were very much like pro immutability. Like nothing should be, you know, you can't change anything. There's no legitimacy in that consensus. I think that's a pretty small like minority of people now, but at the time it was like actually much more contentious than I think people realize. But in that case, like that ability for them to exit wasn't necessarily bad, but like I think the ideal outcome would have probably been that like there was some other solution to like resolve like the tension. But if there's a fundamental disagreement, having that option is like certainly better than not having it, because otherwise there's just no release valve. So again, that's a bit of a long answer, but like I think it's 80% voting, you know, 20% exit, and I think we often focus too much on exit.
Yeah, and you mentioned a few times kind of the inherently like public consensus formation. That's often, I don't know whether I understood you correctly, but seems to be more preferable even to voting in most cases. I wonder though, do you see any kind of danger of kind of like the common phenomenon of like just preference falsification in the case of like forming public consensus without having like that anonymous vote to really, you know, in the case of like social pressures and such, really like exert your true opinion?
Yeah, and so actually it's funny, like we're talking about this in the context of Gitcoin as well. In there's this idea of MACI, which is like this sort of like minimal anti-collusion resistance idea. What it does is basically like hides the vote or the donation in the case of quadratic funding from the public. So if I was to like give you, you know, 10 DAI and say donate to this grant, I would never be able to know whether you actually donated to that grant. I couldn't like track or like trace that. And so I think that idea of like having some degree of like, and I think there's actually a very interesting case to be made that that helps with collusion. The thing it does in exchange is reduces the amount of actual signal or like ability for you to like signal preferences, you know, more broadly. So there's a trade-off between, yes, you want to have some kind of like anonymized voting, but also you want people to be like accountable to their votes and to the reasoning behind them, and to be able to showcase that in a public setting. If, you know, if we just elected a bunch of like anons to like our, you know, various institutions, I think like there'd also be lots of problems with that. I'm like pretty pro and not like anonymization and like and privacy. And like that's actually one of the areas that I was like really passionate about before even crypto was like helping support like donating to like Electronic Frontier Foundation and like, you know, all these different projects. But like I do think there's a degree to which having a public forum and like having a public discussion is important, even if it's pseudo anonymous. But like having some record of someone's like choices and discussion and like and beliefs and behaviors, I think is like really key, because you just end up with otherwise like to your point about exits, like the exit cost and like is just too low. Like it's very easy to like have a bad actor come in, like do something really dumb, and then just like exit the system with like no consequence. And I don't even necessarily mean like, I don't think there necessarily needs to be like legal consequences, just like social consequences for like having some sort of like creating some kind of issue. And so like, you know, in the context of our DAO, for example, like if I, you know, didn't have a way to like necessarily know that someone was like one of the things that we ask people in the DAO is just like, why do you care about public goods? Like, what is the actual like reasoning behind that? And if I didn't have some way to like continuously like track, like, so there's two levels of anonymization, by the way, like pseudo anonymity is like kind of okay. Full anonymity in which like every, like, you can imagine like almost like a, I don't know if you've seen like a Scanner Darkly where like there's sort of like this, or like Waking Life in which there's this sort of like overlay of fluid transformation. Like it's kind of an artistic like visualization of like anonymization, in which like, you know, someone's name or, you know, entire persona changes every time. Like if I had no idea each time I go somewhere that I'm interacting with the same person, and I didn't know whether or not they had like a real answer to that question of like, why do you care about public goods? I think that would be like a huge issue in terms of understanding like, is this person value aligned? Do they really like care about like what's happening? Not that, by the way, like, I mean, that's just like my own opinion. And I'm like, I actually have like very little decision-making power in that context to like decide if someone's in the DAO. It's just something that I think like we've noticed is an important question. But I think the problem of anonymization is tricky. And I don't have like a perfect answer, but I think that like you mostly need to just keep that continuity or you risk a lot of like unintended side effects.
Yeah. Maybe it goes down like back to education again, where it's like actually helping people like form the backbone to kind of like stand up for their beliefs and like their decisions in the end, and like be able to do so kind of in a public or at least like pseudo anonymous way. Maybe lastly, for like some personal questions, I'd be curious to hear, what have you become more skeptical about in maybe the last 10 years? And maybe related to that, what have you become more radicalized or convinced of?
Good question. I think on the one hand, I've definitely become more skeptical of the idea that you can simply run, you know, I think there was a point at which like I thought, oh, well, you can just run a DAO, you know, entirely decentralized with no structure. Everyone can kind of coordinate independently. And I think that, you know, especially in when we started the DAO, like kind of seeing how it's evolved, I think having like, I think a lot of people are calling them like sub DAOs or pods at this point, but like I sort of think about them as like just work streams, like very simply. It's kind of a boring term for them, honestly, but like the idea of a work stream is just like, yeah, creating this sort of like smaller executive function within like the overall like organization. And like I think one thing that, yeah, I like become skeptical of is like without that, like those standardized structures in a like larger group, it just becomes way too chaotic. And I think you need to have some kind of like structure there. So that's a very specific example. I think I've also become like a bit more skeptical of the, I definitely think that we are a bit too, especially on crypto Twitter, there's a lot of, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in like in rhetoric, I think. And like, I think the risk we run into is that that rhetoric leads us down like a path where we end up kind of just like accepting, for example, like in the very worst case, like we accept the, you know, metaverse, like the Facebook, you know, Zuckerberg metaverse, and we end up all like living there or whatever. In, you know, the like slightly less like obvious case, but like still pretty obvious case, maybe we end up with like, you know, the world coins of the world, like the like sort of Silicon Valley like companies that are coming in trying to like create projects in the space. We may end up with them kind of like inadvertently taking over and like creating a lot of power, or gaining a lot of power and then creating all these systems that like end up kind of being harmful to the populations they're intended to serve. So like, I am not a huge fan of the eyeball scanning idea. Personally, I think there's a lot of like issues with that particular like model and the way in which it includes the people who are, you know, meant to be part of that decision-making process. So like, on the one hand, I think we have the obvious case of like, you know, everyone kind of agrees, you know, Facebook creating metaverse is probably like not the world we want to end up in. I think most people agree, but like there's some debate still about like the WorldCoin example where it's like more of a Silicon Valley, less of a big tech sort of case. But then you've got these other more pernicious examples, and I'm hesitant to give this one because like I think they're actually doing a very good job overall, and I really like their team. But like, you know, a lot of people have been criticizing Friends with Benefits as being like, for example, as a DAO, it's a DAO that's like mostly just a kind of social club, and you need a certain amount of tokens to get in, and the token price to get in is quite expensive, it turns out, because they've done really well. And so the result of that is that like there's a lot of kind of exclusion from that community, and there's a lot of like questions about like, well, you know, is there sort of like a divide between the people who can and can't be part of that community, and like the sort of inclusiveness of that community. And I think there's a question of probably not in that particular case, because I think they're already doing a lot of really great stuff to like resolve that issue in their case. But in general, like how do we think about, you know, the way in which we want people to interact with the systems we create? And then, you know, going back to the WorldCoin point, how do we want people to also come back and interact with and like give us feedback on the systems and like being involved in the participatory process of building those systems with us. And so there's, yeah, on one hand, this issue of, you know, so the thing I'm skeptical of basically is I'm skeptical of the idea that like we can just avoid defining our values and avoid like having those tough conversations about like what the world we actually want to see is. And like, you know, the solarpunk futures is part of that, but I think even the solarpunk futures is like it's not necessarily sufficient from like a very precise like kind of like tactical level. Like at that level we need to talk about like, you know, the core principles and values that like and articulate those and write those together. I think there's a lot of work happening now with Versus, who's been doing some really great work on this with like their Declaration of Independence stuff. I think MetaGov is doing a bit of work around this, which I think is really interesting. ENS, of course, when they launched the DAO, launched a constitution with it. And I thought that was really like a great model. But I think we need to be like much more intentional about that, lest we end up with like kind of like very different perspectives about like what it is that we're doing. And I think if you look back to, there's a great Stuart Grand book, I think it's from Counterculture to Cyberculture. I forget the exact name of the book now, which is unfortunate. But that sort of like history of Web 1 to Web 2, you know, was very much paved with good intentions. The idea like we would get to this like utopian world. And I think we still, there's a lot of things that we can, you know, do well. Like again, the experiments we can run here that are like really valuable, but we do have to be very careful and like intentional about like what it is that we actually want to do. So those are like, yeah, two things that stand out.
Yeah, right. And then maybe between you and the people that you work with, what's maybe the most contentious theme that seems to repeat itself when you're debating?
Yeah, I mean, probably the idea that, honestly, probably right now, because most of my time is spent in the sort of like DAO sphere, probably the idea that like that I think most people actually agree that like we need to do a better job of defining our values and like going through that process. Although, of course, the tricky part is where people do and don't align on those values, right? But the piece about DAOs is trickier because I think there are a lot of people who genuinely are very tied to the idea that like there is only one type of organization that is a DAO. That is the only way to like run things. And there is only a certain set of like, you know, which is ironic because I mean, like, I don't necessarily think they're wrong. Like, it's a question of like, again, where do we align those like and kind of like put those principles into place. But I think there's often like kind of a rigidness to their thinking about like, what is the, you know, ideal, you know, experiment that we run. And I think, you know, for example, there's a lot of pushback to the idea that like there's any kind of investment in Web3 right now. There's a lot of pushback to the idea that like, you know, NFTs can be valid representations of art or like valid like kind of constructs like for culture. And I think those conversations like that rigidity is often where I have the biggest, like where I have like the most contention, like where I like have like the most like debate, because there's always nuance in those discussions about like, where is the like line that we want to like draw? And we do have to draw that line, but like, certainly like, you know, not everything is going to be like immediately fully decentralized and like, you know, to the points earlier of immutable and trustless. And there's all these terms that have like very loaded sort of like connotations and assumptions. And yeah, I think it's very important for us to just be like, you know, very mindful and intentional about how we actually define those terms in there. And then hopefully, go on to define like together these principles that we can all work off of.
Yeah, makes sense. So lastly, what don't I know that I don't know? What important questions have I not asked you today? Is there anything left unaddressed?
Good question. I mean, there's always more to know. Like, sure. I feel like we can never really cover everything. I feel like this has been a good range of like, it actually got me thinking about a lot of stuff that I haven't like, you know, thought about for a little while, actually, because like when you get like focused in operationally on like the day-to-day stuff that you have to do, you often like forget about like some of the other pieces, and it's important to come back to that. I guess maybe one thing I'd be curious to get your take on would just be, you know, what is the and this is maybe too high a question, but what is the future vision you would want to see for Web3? Like what, and maybe the more tactical, like easier example of this is like, what is the coolest thing that you are seeing in Web3 right now that stands out to you that, you know, is a representation of the future that you want to see?
Yeah, so I mean, this interview is certainly connected in collaboration with Vita, and I feel like obligated, but also sincerely, want to give them a shout out. I think in general, and I wouldn't consider myself like super deep in the Web3 space myself, but what I like to see is definitely a lot more application of or like bridging of the digital sphere with kind of actually like concrete projects, be it in science or maybe also journalism, like rethinking structures like that, but definitely taking kind of a lot of the innovation and also a lot of the money that has been made like in this space and actually thinking about the physical world and how we can, again, like you said, run a bunch of experiments and kind of export this mindset of structures are malleable, we can actually rethink a lot more, and taking that like confirmation that we've gotten from like doing that in like the digital space and actually rethinking like a lot of institutions in the physical world as well. So I think that's like more of that, more ideas that are actually touching like the physical space, because I think we still have a lot to do in the physical. I definitely don't want to live in like the metaverse, and I think there's a lot to be done that can be done, hopefully, in like the next few decades. Yeah.
That's a really important point that like, I think we touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but like, yeah, the point of like, you know, like climate change was the one example, I guess I think I like gave, and we did a climate change round in the previous grants round 12. And of course, as you mentioned, which I should have mentioned, we also did a longevity round. And I think that point of like, what are the spaces that like both of those are great examples of spaces that historically of being underfunded, but that also have like clear, massive positive externalities when they're actually, you know, achieved. Like, although I know some people are like, you know, oh, like, do we want like everyone to live forever? But I think there's almost even a really important like side note, which is, you know, there's other things that that research like actually achieves, even if not immortality. Like there's other like things that we haven't been thinking about in terms of what aging means or what disease means, that are coming through like thinkers in that field. So those sorts of things, the decentralized science that we're doing, the, you know, way in which we're sort of like, you know, to your point, interacting with our physical spaces, all of that is just like, I think really important and is something that we definitely don't, yeah, think enough about. Like we are very much caught up in, especially in the last couple of years, like just with the pandemic and so forth, like we're caught up in the digital world. Like we almost forget that, you know, this is all contingent on other physical substrates.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good note to end it on. Scott, thanks so much for your time. You were super generous with it. And yeah, we'll link to more stuff definitely below. And yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk soon. Cheers.